You're listening to On the Vine, a podcast about Ivy League basketball, brought to you by IvyHoopsOnline.com.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another episode of On the Vine, a podcast about Ivy League basketball, brought to you by the folks here at HoopsOnline.com. I'm your host, Peter Andrews, and I'm excited to introduce our panel tonight. We have a five-man panel, so we're going to introduce it like it's a basketball team. First up, he's a 5'11" shooting point guard from Princeton, George Toothless Tiger Clark. George, say hello.
Thank you, Peter. Glad to be here again.
At shooting guard, a 6'1" guard from Columbia. That's me, Peter Andrews, your host. A 6'3" small forward from the University of Pennsylvania, Mike Toney. Mike, how's it going?
Good. Like George, I will foul anybody.
A 6'5" forward from Harvard, it's Mike James.
How's it going, Peter?
Pretty good, pretty good. And a 6'5" center from Yale, Ian Halpern. Ian, welcome to the show.
Feed me the rock. Feed me the rock, Pete.
Perfect. I will do that. We are here tonight, and we're about to get into it. We have to start with something a little bit more serious. That's not really about basketball. And what's going to happen is myself, Mike Toney, and Ian have a couple things to say about this, and then we're gonna get into the meat of the show. And that's the Jack Montague situation, which has sort of snowballed from the last couple weeks. As we talked about on last week's show, senior captain Jack Montague withdrew from Yale suddenly earlier in the month. Before their home game on Friday against Harvard, his former teammates wore shorts in warm-ups with the name of the school spelled backwards and the word Gucci on the back with Montague's number 4. Seemed innocent enough. Gucci is Montague's nickname. But it came out on Monday, and to be clear, we're relying here on reporting from the Yale Daily News that there's more to the story. Posters went up around Yale's campus asking the basketball team to, quote, stop supporting a rapist. The implication of the posters is that Montague left the team and the school because of an incident of sexual violence. And it's further clear that despite Justin Sears' proclaiming that we just wanted to make it clear as possible that Jack is one of our brothers, that the team knew that this cloud is hanging over Montague. We knew that there was going to be a reaction to wearing the shirts. That's what Justin Sears said. And it's also further clear from YDN's reporting that the posters against Montague were taken down by members of the basketball team. Now, we don't know the specifics of what's going on with Montague. Obviously, of course, he's innocent of whatever the accusation is until he's proven guilty. And I'm personally unsure whether anonymous accusations on flyers is an effective way of ending campus sexual assault. But that being said, I speak for myself in saying that the Yale basketball team should be ashamed of how they've handled this situation. They should be ashamed. This team, their representatives of Yale, their representatives who are two or three wins away from doing something that the school hasn't seen in 55 years. And what they did with that spotlight was that they rallied together around and defended someone who has been accused of sexual assault. And without knowing the facts, it's this sort of blind, unequivocal support for someone just because they're on the same team as you that contributes to a campus atmosphere that can be unsafe for women. And that's the atmosphere that we're all trying to end on campus right now. We don't know the facts on the ground, but it's clear that the Bulldogs decided to insert themselves into this controversy. That's something they didn't need to do. It's something they shouldn't have done. And I hope on reflection that they all realize that this was a big mistake. Mike?
Yeah, I agree with you 100% there, Peter. I mean, to state the obvious, this is clearly a disaster beyond basketball for everyone without knowing much more than we know right now, no matter how this ultimately plays out. And given the historical context, it's that makes it arguably even worse. We're talking about a university in which more than 16% of all students on Yale's campus reported experiencing a sexual assault or an attempted sexual assault at one time, according to a 2015 report from the Association of American Universities. The Huffington Post had reported 3 years ago in 2013 that Yale had found six students guilty of what was termed non-consensual sex during the first half of that year and allowed all of them to continue pursuing a diploma there. There's still a scarcity of facts pertaining to Jack Montague's withdrawal from Yale, but it's safe to say that the team's show of support for Montague has proven incredibly divisive on campus, as one might expect given the nature of the withdrawal that seems apparent now. And the members of the varsity basketball team are reportedly tearing down posters accusing them of supporting a rapist all over campus, even at the entrance of Payne Whitney Gym itself, is truly a shocking thing. And it's a position that the players are responsible for putting themselves in. I understand Yale's basketball players wanting to show support for a teammate they care very much about, but I think we all know or recognize that college athletics should be about uniting not just teams but campuses. So it's unfortunate that a team that before Montague's withdrawal looked perfectly positioned to unite this campus in celebration now looks increasingly likely to divide it through suspicion and anger. And now there's a layer of national scrutiny, as evidenced by articles on the subject by Jezebel and the Big Lead, that is now enveloping this program, and specifically Jack Montague himself, that probably wouldn't have been there if the team had not chosen to make the show of support that it did. So regardless of how the situation with Jack Montague plays out, this at the very least is an opportunity to recognize the comparatively high frequency of sexual misconduct against women and keep applying pressure on the university to improve greatly in that regard.
Yeah, you know, I don't have too much to add to what you guys said. I think we're all on the same page. I thought it was a pretty shocking thing to see that sort of public statement from the Yale basketball team last week. And so I've been trying to put myself in their shoes. And I agree with Mike that it's got to be a really difficult thing to see your leader and captain be accused of such things. And they're probably getting, you know, one side of the story, and they probably feel like they need to be loyal friends and teammates. And it's pretty clear that, you know, at least at the bottom of this, there's some disagreement about the facts of the case. We obviously don't know. So I can see how this could happen. Now, that said, it's such a bad look for everybody involved, and you have to, you know, as somebody who goes to Yale, you know, you're a smart person. You have to know how this is going to look. You have to know that, you know, by publicly supporting someone allegedly accused of this type of behavior, the public is going to see that statement as a total affront to the alleged victim, no matter what you believe happened. And you have to see that. And they failed to do so. And the team, if they're going to be supportive of their old teammate Jack, that's something they really should have kept private, in my opinion. The facts will eventually come out, but as an alum, it seemed completely inappropriate and honestly embarrassing, with the student section chanting his name and the warm-ups with his name on it. Not a good look for anybody involved, from Sears, who then denied that they knew what was going on, which seems really hard to believe. And then Coach Jones to kind of not have control of the locker room, all the way up to Tom Beckett, the AD. Especially, as Mike said, in the context of these issues that have happened in recent years that have plagued the campus with regards to sexual misconduct. So really disappointing at a time when we really should be able to focus on some important and unusual achievements for the basketball team.
Yeah, I think that's all there is to be said. We did have a question come in on the chat, which I'm just going to say, I'm not going to answer this, but I do just want to put it out there. Someone asked us whether if the coaching staff knew the team planned to wear the t-shirts, does that cost someone their job? I'm not going to speculate about that, but I think it is. I just want to echo Ian's point about institutionally, like who on the team, you know, in terms of said they could wear the shirts, did or did not know. I think that's worth pointing out. But that's, I think, all we're going to say on this topic. You know, if you have, it's a tough situation, and I can only hope it's resolved in a way that, you know, restores some semblance of dignity to the basketball team. Let's move back onto the court, and let's get out of New Haven. All things being equal, I am always pro getting out of New Haven. Of course, where we're going next, I don't actually much like that much better. We are going to go down to Princeton, New Jersey, and talk about what happened last weekend. The big game last weekend was between the Columbia Lions and the Princeton Tigers on Friday at Jadwin Gymnasium. It did not go as I would have hoped. In fact, it was the exact same score line as the last time that Princeton and Columbia met, 88-83, a victory for the Tigers. So we'll start with George Clark.
First time in program history that that has happened, incidentally.
What has happened?
That an identical score between two opponents occurs in the same year.
Well, I will leave it really? I'll leave it to you to speculate on what that might mean about the paranormal guidance of Yale season. Let me start with you, George, who I know you were there. What did you see from the Tigers in this one?
I saw a team incredibly hot shooting again at home, among across the spectrum of the team. Princeton took control of that game pretty early, almost lost control of the game late in the second half, but with some timely, a very timely three-point shot by Stephen Cook as the shot clock expired, kind of restored order. Columbia used a zone to great effect coming back from the second half deficit, kind of befuddled us for a while. They got back in the game, but this team is very resourceful when it has to be, and kept things under control. Princeton was out-rebounded. Strangely enough, each team scored the same number of field goals. Columbia attempted quite a few more shots than Princeton did, but Henderson traded twos for threes. I remember remarking to a fellow who was sitting next to me as Mauro Lowe scored again, that was too easy, was my comment. It seemed that Columbia scored a lot of almost uncontested layups. The rationale was that they weren't able to attempt very many three-point shots, and they didn't make too many. In fact, Princeton had 13 threes, which was one more than Columbia attempted. So the difference in the scoring came from the three-point line, and it's been a very effective game plan for Henderson lately. He goes small, he runs shooters off the three-point line, and as a result, he kind of surrenders a lot of easy twos. We got in foul trouble pretty early in that game in the first half. By the time it was over, there was not a great disparity in fouls. But on the whole, it was just a great game by a hot team before a nice crowd, a great atmosphere. Governor Christie was there, in fact.
He was let out. He was let out of his hostage situation.
No, excuse me. That was not
a couple.
Last
that
week.
Was the Yale game.
Yeah. Right.
I want to ask a question to Michael James. I was actually listening to the last time Mike James was on the show before we started today, so I would have some nice ammunition to use. And you said in relation to a Columbia Cornell game the second weekend of the season. You know, I'm paraphrasing in an uncharitable way. Columbia shot 13 of 24 from three. they're not going to repeat that very often, which I would then suggest means you're saying that the victory was illegitimate. Now, Princeton shot 13 of 21 against Columbia and Jadwin on Friday. What do you make of that?
Well, I think I want to go back to something that George said, because I really – we've talked a lot about different coaches around the league, and I certainly have been very much on the Kyle Smith bandwagon. I think people know that that I've talked about him a lot. And I think that I've also been sort of on the anti-Tommy Amaker in-game coaching bandwagon. But I really talked a lot about Mitch. And this coaching performance that he put together against Columbia in this game was – tremendous, and what he's done all season has been absolutely tremendous. It's sort of gone under the radar, but if you look at this Princeton team, they're basically their 3-point attempts for field goal attempts, they're 40th in the nation, and more importantly, in what they allow, they're 14th in the nation in terms of the fewest 3-point attempts per field goal attempt that they allowed. So what they did to Columbia in this game, allowing them to take just 12 threes out of 58 shots, was such an incredible game plan that he basically said, you know what, I'm going to let Columbia get as many two-pointers as they can make, but I'm not going to let them play the lottery and beat me. At the other end, I'm going to play the lottery, and I'm going to take every open three that I can possibly get. And they shot, you know, out of their 47 shots, 21 of them came from three. You know, you can sort of look at it and say maybe they should have made something closer to 8 rather than 13. But at the same time, like, I think that for me, less about how well Princeton shot and more about the disparity of the shots they were able to get off, that was the impressive part of this game. At the same time, I think that if you're going to allow 1.22 points per possession, which is what Princeton did allow Columbia, you're not going to win many games. And they probably were a little lucky to win this game. But I will say, if you look back at the 10-minute mark, when this game was a little more in Princeton's control, Columbia was closer to about 1 point per possession. So it's entirely possible that Princeton could have gotten away with shooting a little less well from three and maybe not been up as comfortably. Maybe things play out differently over those final 10 minutes. But certainly it was a very good shooting performance from Princeton, that if they really did need to beat a Columbia team scoring 1.22 points per possession, they probably wouldn't count on that every time. That's absolutely true.
Peter, as you remember, last year, Mauro Loh had 11 himself.
I do remember that. I remember that very distinctly because, as I keep telling the story, I told you before the game he was going to hit 40, and he only hit 37, and that was the margin of victory. So I take the blame for that one. But anyways, what were you going to say?
To Michael's point, Mitch Henderson was not going to allow that to happen again, and he did not. Not that the beautiful thing from Princeton's standpoint is that at home we shoot very, very well, and we know we're going to shoot well, and we do. And it's as I pointed out in a post, I think, we've had four double-figure scorers almost every game in the Ivy League, and I don't think it's been the same four guys on consecutive nights. That's just terrific. Got a tough road trip coming up. I know we'll talk about it, but if we can shoot close to the way we shot at home, we should be all right.
One remarkable thing about this game, by the way, Columbia had 7 assists on those 31 made baskets. 23% assist rate. That is insane. So, yeah. I mean, Princeton clearly was selling out against the three, and you could see it if you were watching the game. For me, that was the next day on American Sports Network because they showed it on delay. But basically, they were selling out and letting people drive right to the hole and basically saying, go ahead, do it. We're not letting you take a three. And that's primarily why the assist rate was so remarkably low for Columbia in that game.
Ian, you want to chime in?
Yeah. Obviously, I was watching this game closely as a Yale fan. I think it was maybe the best chance for somebody to knock off Princeton before we may go to a playoff. And so... when Columbia made that run in the last 5 minutes or so, I got to the edge of my seat, and the way that Princeton played those last couple minutes made me very nervous about a potential playoff. They were so well coached, so patient, so clutch with that Steve Cook three from the corner, and then followed that up with a 35-second possession and a Kennedy three that just buried Columbia. That is end game management right there. you know, we've talked about their depth, just like George just talked about. Add to that the coaching that we've been going through and the way that they know how to finish games. It just looks like a championship team right now. I'm not trying to jinx them or anything. Obviously, that's exactly what I'm trying to do.
Sound
but
like you are.
I just thought the way they closed that out, I was very impressed.
Several weeks ago, I had the occasion to visit with Coach Carrillo, who sits high above Carrillo Court for every home game. And we talked about Kennedy, and he said, he's a rally killer. I said, Coach, what do you mean? He said, if a team is down 5 and they get to 3, Kennedy will make a shot. If they're down 8 and they score 5 in a row, Kennedy will make a shot. And that has proven to be the case. The only basket he made against Columbia was that 3 that Ian just talked about. I think he was 1 for 5, and also 6 of 6 from the free throw line. So this kid is just a treasure. Boy, I hope he continues to play as well as he has. I think on another team, if he was getting more minutes, he might have a real shot at Rookie of the Year, but he won't. He probably won't get a lot of consideration for that. But he's a really terrific player.
I want to ask a question to Mike James, and I realize it's going to seem like I'm having him on the show basically just to torture him. But, you know, Ian talks about Princeton having great end-of-game management. I have a totally different theory as to why Princeton is succeeding this year, and I want to get your take on it. Because I know you talk a lot about numbers, and you look at the league from a kind of a macro perspective. So my theory, as I've explained on this program before, is that before the season, for reasons unknown, Mitch Henderson et al. Were visited by Satan, and they made a deal by which Princeton would be entitled to win the Ivy League. I don't know what the consideration was there. I don't know what the terms of the deal were. And as we've seen this season, any time things look bad for Princeton, the devil and his nefarious agents swoop in and give Princeton the victory in the game. So I want to ask you, have you seen anything in the numbers to support my theory?
Well, you have to understand that, you know, sort of from my Harvard background, I endured, was it 24, 25 straight losses at Jadwin, many through some really weird end-of-game circumstances. So I'm inclined to say that I understand where you're coming from. That being said, you know, I think that this Princeton team, you know, this is as I always like to say, this is just one trial out of thousands of trials that could have happened. And they have been pretty lucky in this campaign to, you know, be where they are right now. They were very lucky to escape that Penn game. They're very lucky to escape the game at Columbia. But at the same time, what I really like to look at are these efficiency margins in league play. And right now, if you look at it, Princeton is barely second to Yale in that, and well clear of Columbia. So when you look at it from that perspective, I mean, you know, it would be hard to say from this efficiency margin standpoint that Princeton shouldn't be right there with Yale and a step in front of Columbia. So I'm a little less inclined to say that it's some sort of voodoo magic or devil magic, even though I can understand where you're coming from, given sort of, you know, my history with watching this Princeton program play Harvard. But at the same time, you know, from the efficiency margin standpoint, they deserve to be where they're at.
See, I would say that the devil lurks in the efficiency margins. But,
just to counter, you know, if you look at Pomeroy's luck metric, the top Ivy team in terms of luck is your Princeton Tigers. Just saying.
That doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, if you...
That's all
you
Peter know, was you, really looking for.
Yeah, you know, I think luck is, you know, you can see the nefarious tentacles of Satan himself lurking in those numbers. So let's shift gears a little bit. We'll get into Columbia later in the show, and we talk about the weekend that's coming up, because I have obviously a lot to say about Columbia, always. But, so the other reason I had Mike, that I like to have Mike James on the show, is to talk about 2-bit Ivy, which is my favorite fantasy concept in the world. So let's start with, I want you to lay out for me the scenario in your mind, and possibly in reality. I actually think it's more possible than I let on. I just think it's funny. What's the scenario in your mind by which, in 2 weeks, both Yale and Princeton are in the tournament?
I think we're down to one specific one at this point. Basically, Princeton needs to do very well on this road trip at Harvard and Dartmouth, and we can get into the weekend preview later, but I think they will. And then I think it needs to do very well disposing of Penn. Yale needs to close out the weekend 13-1. It needs to find a way to survive this brutal road trip with all the circumstances surrounding the team. It needs to find a way to sweep, get to 13-1. If both get to 13-1 and we get to the Palestra at 5 p.m. right before Selection Sunday, I think we'll have a nice week of people realizing, holy crap, if Princeton loses, they're a pretty darn strong at-large contender. So I think there'll be a nice like marketing build there over the course of that week. And then if we can get a situation where, much like the last couple playoffs, it's a very close game, Princeton comes up on the short end of it, I think that Princeton at that point, by, you know, this easy bubble solver metric, which I've talked about, and a variety of other metrics, would be one of the biggest snubs to miss in this sort of new era of an expanded at-large field with a little more knowledge of how to correct for some of the RPI's inaccuracies. So I think that that's the one specific scenario, and I'll tell you, that's not very likely to happen at this point still, even where we stand today. But if it does happen, I would be stunned to see Princeton miss the field.
And so I guess the question that sticks in my mind, and I'll get your take on this, and I also want to get Mike Tony in because he's been sitting there patiently for like half an hour to say something. Maybe not so patiently.
That's good.
How do you think, because I think the biggest obstacle to 2-bit Ivy is, you know, I think the numbers are one thing, but when you look at the way the committee makes its decisions, and they have such a strong bias in favor of certain programs, certain metrics, certain conferences, I guess I'm not sure how I see the Princeton surmounting that obstacle. Do you think it's solely the case where, like, that week built into a playoff, there would be some sort of intrinsic momentum building to it, or do you think that the committee would actually sit down and say, like, oh, look, we're going to give Princeton a fair shake? That's what I'm skeptical about.
Sure. I think that, I think that bracketologists tend not to lend as much credence to the number of teams that are under consideration. I think they tend to draw the field rather narrowly. They also live in the moment. And, you know, looking down the road, they're not really looking there. They assume if Princeton gets a 13-1, they're as dominant as they are, they're going to be in. They're going to win the bid. That's not a big deal. I think that, you know, when I look at the way this situation shakes out, I look at 2013, I look at that Middle Tennessee State team that had basically the same profile as Princeton and wound up getting a relatively surprise at-large bid. So you can sort of point to one scenario where a team like Princeton just snuck up on everyone. And, you know, it's clear that there's a blind spot there. I think as well, if you look at teams that are comparable to Princeton, teams that have been left out for very specific reasons, they still wound up one seeds in the NIT, which means they were sort of the last teams being debated or were very high on the at-large docket. I just think we need to get there. I think we need to get there first, get through this weekend, get to the 2-13-1 teams, and then I think that, you know, everyone's going to have to start realizing this and realizing how there are so many tremendous comps, and if Princeton were to be completely off the radar at that point, it would be something that would be basically unprecedented.
Mike, can I ask you a question? Is the reason that I haven't heard a peep about the possibility of a Yale at large just the fact that Princeton's about, you know, around 30 in the RPI and Yale's back at 50 in the RPI? Because beyond that, you know, all non-conference losses were on the road for both teams, all within the top 150 for both teams. I mean, Princeton, in my opinion, someone who watches the league pretty closely, does pass the eye test a little bit more than Yale, but I know the committee's not looking at that. So could you just speak a little bit to why we're only talking about Princeton?
Yeah, I think it's a numbers game with the RPI. I don't think the RPI is the end-all, be-all, and I think the committee is aware of that. But at the same time, it is a plus for Princeton. It is sort of a neutral for Yale. I think that Illinois is going to finish outside the top 100. As far as I'm aware, Princeton is not going to finish with any team any losses below, like, 45. And also, Yale winning winds up making it like almost to a top 30 point if it wins out, including a win over Princeton. So Princeton's going to have a really nice win there to sort of play around with. That would sort of be the same on the other end too, but you're talking about a 30 RPI team with a win over another 30 RPI team versus a, you know, a 50s RPI team with a win over a 30s RPI team. So, and that's where I'm at on that. I don't think, and I also think that potentially the Jack Montague stuff and being down a person could play into the at-large bid talk as well, whereas Princeton's at full strength.
I think, to be clear, if Princeton gets an at-large bid in the NCAA tournament, that would be the surest proof of all that there's some supernatural forces at work here. Let's talk about Yale's last weekend. Setting aside this talk of Princeton for the time being, we'll get back to them. Yale with victories at home over Harvard and Dartmouth. That Dartmouth team, though, is such a perennial problem for the Bulldogs. Mike Toney, how did they get out of that?
I gotta clear the cobwebs out of my throat. Sorry.
I'm doing my best here.
The Ben Carson of our podcast.
I know. Well, you know. Fruit salad of our lives, but
you can read the rest of Mike Toney's plan on BenCarson.com.
Got a 7-point. No, I mean, talking about Dartmouth, how Yale got out of it was Mekhi Mason, really, with that one. All you need is one shot sometimes at basketball, and it was that, you know, the elbow jumper that tied the game there. I think you have to worry, though, and this is something that we've talked about for the last couple of podcasts now, is Mekhi Mason, you know, being the bellwether for this team. You know, how he goes, Yale will go more so than anyone else, even Justin Sears and Brandon Sherrod. It's twice now in the last four games, I think, as Ian has also noted, Mekhi Mason has shot 18 times. That's a higher rate than we've seen from him, with Jack Montague in the lineup. I think we've got a situation now where you look at this Yale backcourt, and it's so, it was thin before, Jack Montague withdrew, but now, you know, I'm not sure where you're going to get the offensive usage in production. I don't think Trey Fills is there. I don't think Anthony Dallier necessarily has shown that skill set. I don't know where it comes from. I think with a team like Dartmouth that you know, gets steals, plays physical, can grind you out, that's sort of been their MO in these upsets against Harvard and, I guess Yale itself over the last couple of years. So, you know, Yale, yeah, they're playing ugly now, and Dartmouth is probably one of the Ivy's most well-equipped based on the makeup of their roster and their style that can actually bludgeon them at their own game, and they very nearly did that again. I don't think that's necessarily Princeton's style. I don't think, I'm trying to think, well, Cornell is kind of a wild card in the way they play, but I think that actually favors Yale with the, how up and down they like to play and kind of beating themselves there up in Ithaca. I think that, you've got a team right now that is more reliant on Mekhi Mason than Princeton has been reliant on any one player, arguably, since Ian Hummer. So, that's not a good situation to be in, even though Mekhi Mason has generally proven that he pretty good in the clutch. You just don't want to come down to one person, especially since he got increasingly beaten, banged up as that game went on. He seemed to have a tweaked ankle, not looking that great. So, you know, that's Yale right now. They're on the precipice, and they're, you know, looking mighty precarious at the moment.
So, Ian, what was going through your mind watching the conclusion of that game? And I guess generally, more broadly, what are your thoughts on how Yale's weekend went?
Oh, just that Dartmouth was our kryptonite after last year.
They are green, so that makes sense.
Man, I couldn't believe what was happening before my eyes, and you know, I really thought it was over when they turned the ball over in that final minute. But you know, Makai Mason steps up. What a huge, huge shot! And I know I've been a bit of a downer about Yale's chances since this Jack stuff went down, but you know, and we've talked a lot about the lack of depth and how you know how big a deal that is. But if you just look at, and one more thing. George was talking earlier about how four Princeton players were in double figures again, and you know how incredible that is. Yale has five really good players right now, and if they had Jack, man, if only if. We had five guys in double figures against Dartmouth, and finally we saw a big game from Nick Victor. Him stepping up was huge. Makai hitting the big shot was huge. Sherrod had another huge game. We know what Justin Sears can do. Like, there's a lot of firepower on this team, and I know it, there's just such a small margin for error at this point. But, you know, if you can get those five guys out on the court, keep them out of foul trouble, Nick Victor, if he can show up and have another game, you know, this is as talented a team as we've seen in New Haven in a long, long time. It's just the depth. I don't know if you can overcome the depth. I don't know if you're going to get calls on the road this weekend. I mean, we can transition into talking about this upcoming weekend, so I guess I'll hold this stuff, but I was just so relieved to get out of last weekend alive, and I thought the five starters did a hell of a job. Still concerned about the depth.
Well, before we move to this upcoming weekend, I want to get Mike James's take on a couple things, one of which is, to give me your sort of sense of, as compared to Mike and Ian, how Yale's doing, but also Harvard, who struggled, and there's been some questions about Zaina Adasamwan's playing time, particularly down the stretch in these games. So if you could take a couple minutes and just, A, your sense on Yale, and B, Harvard wrapping up a pleasantly disappointing season, what your thoughts are on how that's going.
I mean, starting with Yale, I think that this is a team much like it feels like a couple years ago, when it was sort of punching above its weight class, and you sort of knew that the fall was coming. I am so happy as like a 13-1 guy that there's only two games left here, because this Yale team is just really like stumbling to the finish line at this point. I think Makai Mason will go this weekend. But at the end of the day, like, he's not 100%. And if he's not 100%, like, what do you have in that backcourt? It's really bad. I mean, Cornell is many things, many, many things. But the one thing it constantly is harassing. And, I mean, maybe Yale survives Cornell, and that ridiculous, you know, sort of havoc defense that really, if you beat it, you get free baskets. Maybe it survives that, but like, what does it have left after it survives that to go to Columbia? I mean, this is the real concern, is that even if Yale can survive Cornell, it is just so little depth at this point that, I mean, I think it's going to be probably, in reality, if you take fatigue into play here and where it sits, it's probably a 4 or 5 point dog at Columbia when it finally can make it down to Columbia after putting away Cornell, sort of hopefully for its sake. And I mean, so my feelings on Yale, but I think also like people are really not looking at how good of a season Justin Sears is having. He's having a great season. Brandon Sherrod is having a fantastic season. Their front court is keeping them in games, even if like the counting stat production isn't there. So I really do think that this is going to come down to, can Makai Mason, is he healthy enough to go at 100% this weekend? And Are those two guys around him, Victor and Daly, are they going to be able to stay on the court? Are they going to be able to stay out of foul trouble and give 30 minutes over two nights? Because if you've got to dip into that bench for, you know, 30 minutes for the guards, you know, sort of as a backup, 40, 50, even more, I don't see how this team survives this weekend with the sweep. And then getting to Harvard, Harvard is a mess right now. There's just every player on that team is banged up with some sort of injury. This is not a very deep team to begin with. I think we saw what Harvard could be when it was pretty healthy at the end of December in Hawaii. I think we saw that this was a team that had a sort of a stalker's chance in the race if everything went its way. But then the Ivy League race started and everything didn't go its way. I think it'd be happy to make it to the end of the season and get a sense of who it can bring to next season. But I would be very surprised. I don't know who's going to play this weekend. I don't know who they have that's healthy at this point. But I would be surprised if they, you know, if they came close to Princeton, if they gave Princeton any trouble. And they may even have trouble, you know, getting the split against Penn.
These are troubling times for Harvard. And by troubling, I mean deeply pleasant. Yes, crocodile tears being made by Ian Halpern on the video chat here. Let's talk about this Yale-Columbia matchup, which I think is the real interesting one this weekend, and this gives me a chance to talk about Columbia real quick. So after losing the heartbreaker to Princeton on Friday night, Columbia went out and, what's the word I'm looking for? Obliterated the Penn Quakers in a way that I sort of wish they had done more often this year, because they definitely have the capacity to just utterly nuke a team with their three-point shooting, with their ball movement, and with their pretty good defense when you get right down to it. So coming in a little bit hot into this weekend, and Columbia's got a lot to play for. I spoke with Sam Tidings, who's another writer for iHoopsOnline.com, yesterday, and he interviewed Kyle Smith, some of the details of which will be coming out on this very website later on in the weekend. What I can say is that here's where Columbia stands from a postseason perspective. Kyle Smith thinks that they still have an outside chance at the NIT. It depends on results going a certain way. I would imagine part of it is, you know, you got to beat Yale, you got to beat Dartmouth, and you got to do it convincingly enough to move them up in the RPI a good distance. And I'm not sure whether Mike thinks that's conceivable or not. We can get there. And then if not that, obviously they're looking at the CIT, which it's fashionable, can be fashionable to joke about the postseason tournaments that aren't the big two. But the CIT was a big jumping off point for Columbia in 2014, when they made it to the quarters, they played Yale. That was a great, great game. Really great, ambiance on campus. I think it really, that was Mauta Loh's coming out party, Alex Rosenberg. I think that playing in a postseason tournament generally is underrated, so Columbia still has a lot to shoot for. They can also finish the season with, I think, 22 wins, the regular season, by winning out, which is something they haven't done in a decade. And by a decade, I mean 5 decades. It was a, it's going to come down as a disappointing season for Columbia, because in the end of the day, you want to get to the tournament. And that's not happening unless... No, it's not happening. But they have a chance to go out with a bang. Senior night is Saturday. It has been sold out since earlier this week. I crunched the numbers. Columbia is averaging 250 more fans per game for the Ivy League than they have last year. They're averaging about 2,400 in a gym that seats 2,500. And they're going to have a chance to send their 4 seniors out with a bang. So from a Columbia's perspective, that's a huge game. And it's against a Yale team that's given them fits over the last couple years. Really good matchups between those two teams. And I don't know if anyone else on the panel has anything they want to say about this particular matchup. Or if I actually do want Mike James, what do you think that Kyle Smith's NIT dreams have any sense in reality?
Obviously going to depend on a lot of how many of those one seeds lose in their auto bid conference tournaments, the one bid conference tournaments. they need to sweep this weekend. They need to get a lot of things to go their way. I think if they hadn't lost to Longwood, they hadn't lost to that Northwestern game, I think they'd be in a lot better situation right now. But there's still a possible chance.
Well, you're still saying there's a chance, so I'll take that. And they got to get past Dartmouth first, which is not the easiest game in the world. Mike Tony, were you watching that Columbia Penn game on the weekend?
Yeah, you know, I wasn't even mad. You know, when a team is that hot, it's like, you know, what are you going to do? Alex Rosenberg was unstoppable. It's kind of ironic because Steve Donahue's defensive philosophy is, you know, don't give up the three. And that's exactly what they did over and over again. They were missing Max Rothschild, a freshman who didn't play too much when Penn played at Columbia earlier this season, but did a little bit, did enough on defense to make a difference, especially in the front court against Alex Rosenberg. But, yeah, you know, I think, you know, sometimes you just run into a buzzsaw. Columbia has blown out Penn once a year for the last few seasons. It just happens to have been at Levian before this season, and this time that, you know, that sort of got reversed. Columbia was due to win at the Palestra. They hadn't won there since 2010. And so, you know, the law of averages kind of worked out on that one. When you get a team, and, you know, when you're Columbia knows this better than anybody. I mean, there are three Ivy losses, both times to Princeton and then at Yale. You know, they ran into an opponent that, you know, was unstoppable from deep, and they didn't have the horses defensively, you know, to do much with that. They weren't hassling quite enough. I think Penn was guilty of that, especially in the second half after Penn had, you know, made the score 28-26 at one point. And so, you know, that's what you get. And, you know, to circle back to my first observation, you can't be mad at that. You just got to, you know, take your hats off to a team that is resilient enough to respond that way after, you know, losing the, you know, the magnitude of the game that they did the night before.
The other half this weekend that's not located in Levian, Princeton's got to win three games because they have the traditional season ender on Tuesday. George, you can correct me if I'm wrong. It's Harvard first, and then Dartmouth,
yes,
and then Penn.
Harvard tomorrow night.
That's right. So three big games for the Tigers. What's your what do you see for those three games? And then after this, we'll head into our weekend predictions segment, but I want to get your take on where Princeton stands.
Princeton's had a tough time playing in Cambridge for several years. Of course, everybody has, but I've been to several of those games, and it's just a tough environment. I don't know if they're packing the place this year as they have in the past, but you just never go up there thinking, as I don't have the same confidence that Michael James does, that it's not going to be a tough game for Princeton. We can't take that for granted. We were very fortunate that the big center didn't play in New Jersey. He's back. He's banged up, I guess, but he presents a lot of problems. And we've had trouble at Dartmouth at times. I remember a couple of years ago, Will Barrett had 28. Probably the best night of his career, and we lost up there in overtime. And this is a kind of a quirky Dartmouth team. Sometimes they look really good, and it seems to me they're better than their record. But that's a tough trip to go all the way up there from Boston, play it the next night. This is a tough road trip. Everything is riding on it, of course, so I tend to think we're not going to beat ourselves. And then to come home with the traditional season ender, and it's two huge games that night, because the Princeton and Penn women are going to face a situation that they faced 2 years ago. The winner is going to be the Ivy League champion, get to the tournament. And it could be the same situation for the men. They could be facing a situation where they can win the game and win the Ivy League championship. At the very least, they probably will have to win it to get in a playoff. But these are three tough games, always on the road, back-to-back. Of course, it's coming back to Yale, making that trip from Ithaca all the way to Manhattan and then play the next day. That was almost a heartbreaker for us. It turned out to be a real heartbreaker for Peter, but that's a very, very difficult trip. And Mason is playing 36, 38 minutes a game now. So I have to wonder if this could not be a better situation for Kyle Smith at the end of the year to have Yale come in on with a lot riding on it for Columbia, get them at home on senior night.
So you'll be
it's going to be another great weekend.
You'll be a Lions fan this weekend, George. I
certainly am. I love the Lions.
Well, and I will just, before we move into predictions, we got about 9 minutes left in the show, I'll just say that, you know, we're looking for, I'm saying, like, you're looking for signs of the devil. One would be if both Princeton men and women clinched the same night at home, that would be another sign that supernatural forces are at work.
2 years ago, in the same situation, at home, the Penn women just ran the Princeton women out of the gym at home. It was a shock.
Yeah, I was there. That was a great game.
Everyone remembers
that. Princeton had won five in a row. I think they had won five titles in a row. Courtney Banghart hasn't lost too many in her career, but that was a real, real great night for Penn. And this is going to be another big day for somebody, that's for sure.
It'll be a big day for somebody, and let's talk about who that somebody is as we wrap up the show here. Everyone, this year, what we've been doing, everyone gets one prediction. It's going to be about any game, any part of the weekend that you want. Let's start with IVB Ball himself, Mike James. One prediction for the weekend.
Geez. I think that Yale's going to lose at Columbia. I really do, and I think that it's going to finish 12-2 and come up a game short. You know, I think that we'll get to a point where Princeton will have to win that game at home against Penn to clinch the Ivy title. But I think they're going to go into that one not needing to win to be in a playoff, but rather needing to win the Ivy title. I think they're going to win it at 13-1.
Ian Halpern.
My prediction, Peter Andrews, is that we will have a playoff. We will have a playoff because you don't just go to Leed Arena on the road and expect to win. Princeton will lose to Dartmouth on Saturday night. Mike James is correct. Columbia is going to beat Yale on Saturday night. We're going to have two teams at 12-2 after Princeton knocks off Penn, and I will be at the Palestra next Saturday, and I hope some of you will be there.
Well, I will not be there because I live 3,000 miles from the Palestra. And I can think of nothing worse than watching Princeton and Yale in a playoff for the Ivy League championship. But I do like, I think, that Princeton-Dartmouth thing. Underrated possibility. George Clark, your prediction for the weekend.
I think that Princeton and Columbia are going to end up 13-1, and I'm going to join Ian next week at the Palestra, at the Cathedral on Saturday evening.
Fair enough.
On Fox Sports 1.
Yes, on actual TV this year.
Actual
crazy.
TV.
And not even the American Sports Network, which despite the protestations of various people, I do not consider to be actual TV. Mike, Tony, what are your thoughts?
I think that, I was going to say that Princeton is probably more likely to struggle at Dartmouth than at Harvard. I think Dartmouth is... They're just built to give problems to, supposedly superior teams. You know, they can grind it out. You know, they get the usage from, you know, Taylor Johnson's kind of hot right now. Miles Wright and Malik Gill are always wild cards. So, you know, I think that they're going to get trouble, but I'm going to predict that, like Mike James says, that Princeton Tuesday is going to be, it's going to have a NCAA berth on the line because I think Princeton is able to survive. I don't think Yale is able to survive. If there could be a program that has zero momentum, that would be Yale right now.
Right. Well, I guess, is there some science-y thing that momentum can't be negative? I forget the rules of science because I'm in law school, not science school.
Mike, Tony, there's no Penn upper division finish prediction here?
Yeah.
Wow. That's a good one. No, I mean, that would be great. If you could win two out of three, I think getting to 7-7 with this roster would be an amazing feat.
Probably need
sure.
one.
Hey, you only need one, really.
You only need one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you need, if you're Penn at this point, I think it's been a pretty successful season regardless. You know, the Columbia loss is ironic because it leaves a bad taste in their mouth at the Palestra when it's been a bad season there, or a good season there for Penn, as opposed to when under Jerome Allen they were equally bad everywhere. But, you know, yeah, I predict that Penn splits this weekend and then gets crushed by Princeton.
All right, it's time for my prediction, and I would like you all to take a moment and imagine with me the following scenario of events. On Friday night, Yale travels to Cornell and loses. Princeton travels to Harvard and loses. Columbia beats Brown. On Saturday night, Yale travels to Columbia and loses. Princeton travels to Dartmouth and loses. On Tuesday night, Princeton loses again because I don't want to have to deal with them anymore. Leading to the playoff on Saturday in the Palestra between two teams at 11-3, and those two teams, of course, are Yale and Columbia. Boom, did it.
I'm all for it.
I think that the odds of that happening are pretty slim, but it is, you know, hope is a good thing.
Pretty slim.
Run that simulation.
I swear to God, George, yeah. You were gonna. Yeah, I'd be curious. You know, you guys. I don't even know how. I'm gonna admit something, which is I've been following, you know, IVB Ball on Twitter for 6 years and following, and my buckets for the same length of time. And everyone runs their simulations. I don't get how you do that. I genuinely have no idea how you just press a button and it's like, oh, Harvard won the league like 33% of the time. I don't understand it. And that's something that I'm going to come clean here, my sixth season watching Ivy basketball. I still don't get it at all.
I don't have a 1 minute answer for you.
Yeah, I figured it was some proprietary technology from the Ivy B-ball labs, wherever they may be located. Well, it's kind of crazy. It's all come down to this, the regular season coming to an end after, you know, it feels like it just started and we were talking about Cornell possibly being a contender and Harvard possibly being a contender. And, you know, I still remember the first episode of the show this year when we were told right as the show ended that Hans Brace was going to miss the entire season for Princeton. And I thought to myself, well, that just about takes care of Princeton, doesn't it? Unfortunately, that turned out not to be the case. So it's going to be an exciting weekend as we wrap up the regular season. We'll be back next week. I think a special time on Friday where we will either be previewing a playoff or we will be talking about the grand conclusion of all this nonsense. I would like to thank our esteemed starting five tonight. Thank you very much, Ivy B-Ball. Mike James, thank you.
Glad to be here.
Thank you very much to Toothless Tiger, George Clark.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed very much being here with Michael James to hear his insights.
But conspicuously, not the rest of us. I would like to thank Ian Halpern, the founder of this website, for coming on the show. Good luck to the Bulldogs on Friday night only.
Thank you, Peter. Always a pleasure.
And to my co-host and the czar of this website, Mike Tony, thanks very much.
I'll take it. Thank you, Peter.
This has been another episode of On the Vine, the podcast about Ivy League basketball, brought to you by the folks here at ivyhoopsonline.com. Make sure you enjoy all the games this weekend. We'll have a lot of good coverage coming down the site, including you won't want to miss Sam Tiding's exclusive interview with Kyle Smith. That's all coming up this weekend. Enjoy the games. We'll be back next week. I'm Peter Andrews saying so long and enjoy the basketball.